Hello there. Today is Monday, April 3rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, is the White House ready to act alone when it comes to North Korea?
At some point, we need to see definitive actions by China condemning North Korea and not just calling them out for it.
Lawmakers vote this week on the president's pick for Supreme Court.
It's highly, highly unlikely that he'll get 60.
What our allies are saying about the U.S.-Russia investigations. Also ahead, details on The Zookeeper's Wife, a new film about World War II. It's all on today's International Edition. President Donald Trump says the U.S. is prepared to act alone if China doesn't take a tougher stand against North Korea's nuclear program. Trump's comments coming during an interview with the Financial Times just days before he's set to host Chinese President Xi Jinping at his Mar-a-Lago estate in South Florida. The two are expected to discuss a number of issues, including North Korea, trade, and territorial disputes in the South China Sea. Appearing on ABC's This Week Sunday, U.S. Ambassador to the U.N. Nikki Haley said, it's time for China to act.
No longer take the excuses from China that they're concerned too. They need to show us how concerned they are. They need to put pressure on North Korea. The only country that can stop North Korea is China, and they know that. And I think that you saw when Secretary Tillerson went to Beijing, that was a way of putting pressure. You're going to see President Trump meet with President Xi, and a lot of conversation, and the most important conversation, will be how we're going to be dealing with the nonproliferation of North Korea.
Well, digging deeper into this, VOA's Victor Beatty asked Troy Stangerone at the Korea Economic Institute what the president means by going alone with regard to North Korea.
I think what he's talking about is we have secondary sanctions in place, which would allow us to take and go after Chinese banks and businesses which are doing business with North Korea and helping to facilitate not just trade with North Korea, but also its acquisition of the parts and material it needs to build its nuclear weapons and missile program. And so what I would expect the Trump administration to do is to utilize those tools to go more directly after these types of entities to try and slow down North Korea's nuclear progress and also take and apply pressure on North Korea to bring it to the table.
Well, that's what senior U.S. officials are telling Reuters. Among the options being considered, that a national review of North Korean policy has been completed just ahead of Mr. Trump's meeting with Xi Jinping in Mar-a-Lago in Florida this week.
And it was critical to get this done prior to the meeting. This way, this can be one of the top agenda items. With the review potentially completed, it's still not clear if President Trump has signed off on the options. It'll allow the two to focus on what tasks they have in terms of dealing with North Korea, what options are on the table, and how likely those options are to be able to be of benefit to both China and the United States.
Is this, do you consider this a policy change or shift?
I think it's more a policy intensification. If you look at many of the things that either have been suggested through rumor before the policy review began, or even now that some of it is starting to come out, we're still talking about, one, that the option of military strikes are not off the table, which we would never necessarily take off as well. But also it's more about utilizing the sanctions tools to take and, one, convince the North Koreans that they really can't continue down this path. But two, to try and find a way to encourage China to be more helpful in terms of, one, applying pressure to North Korea. But two, we have a situation with China to where they provide oil every month to North Korea. It's not something that's provided through trade, but rather it's aid that they need to also consider taking and cutting back on these types of things to really send a signal to the North Koreans that this is a program they cannot continue to develop.
Well, China typically does not react well to pressure.
That's very true. I think that's one reason why some of this right now is being put out there, but it's also being put out in a more subtle fashion. It's not direct. If you look at even President Trump's comments, he said that, you know, it would be good if China helps, but that we'll take actions if it does not. And that, unfortunately, though, that wouldn't be good for anyone. And so while I think they're trying to signal to China what they'd like to do, I think they're also being cognizant that being too confrontational publicly with China will likely not deliver the results they want.
We know that back in the previous decade of this century, the Bush administration did curtail North Korea's access to the global financial system. That seemed to be somewhat effective. Will this work a second time around?
I think it's going to be difficult. When we look at sanctions, and specifically financial sanctions, this is something that can work, but it is going to be a long, drawn-out process. If you consider the case of Iran, and we need to realize that one example isn't necessarily sufficient and that North Korea is different, it took years for the sanctions to take and eventually bring Iran to the table and to a point to where it would be willing to reach a deal with the United States, the European Union, and the rest of the permanent members of the Security Council. If we think about North Korea and look at it in the same situation, during that period, Iran was still able to trade with the rest of the globe. We need to be cognizant that there are other means of providing payment, both in other currencies and other types of payment, that I'm sure North Korea is utilizing. And that even if you look recently at how companies are trying to get back into the Iranian market, they're using many of these methods as well. And so this is something that will make life more difficult. It will take and it will slow North Korea, but it is not necessarily an end in itself.
That's Troy Stangerone, Senior Director of Congressional Affairs and Trade at the Korea Economic Institute. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. Search continues for survivors in the deadly Columbia mudslides. Donald Trump turns up the heat on international trade. In the war on child porn, the U.S. turns wounded soldiers into hunters. And sci-fi cancer therapy is fighting brain tumors. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com. And on our VOA mobile app, this is International Edition. Well, as the U.S. Senate prepares for a confirmation vote Monday for President Trump's Supreme Court nominee, Neil Gorsuch, Democratic opposition continues to mount. Three more Democratic senators announced their opposition to Gorsuch on Friday, setting up a confrontation with Republicans. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer on NBC's Meet the Press on why members of his party are deciding to vote no.
What happened was that when Gorsuch refused to answer the most rudimentary questions in the hearings, after there were many doubts about him to begin with, he wouldn't even answer whether he supported Brown v. Board. Even Judge Roberts, who was very reticent, did that. There was a seismic change in my caucus, and it's highly, highly unlikely that he'll get 60. That's right.
Well, but also on Meet the Press, Republican Senate Leader Mitch McConnell argued there's no reason to reject Gorsuch.
Unanimously well qualified by the American Bar Association, 99% of the time in the majority, 97% of his opinions were unanimous, only one time reversed by the Supreme Court. There's no rational basis, no principled reason for voting against Neil Gorsuch, and that's what's before the Senate this week.
Democrats have said they'll use a delaying procedure called a filibuster that requires 60 votes to win a confirmation in the 100-seat Senate. Republicans control the Senate by 52-48 margin, but if Democrats can garner 41 votes, they'd be able to sustain the filibuster. As of Friday, 36 Democrats said they'd support the filibuster, but so far only three Democrats say they'll vote yes for Gorsuch. Michael Flynn, the retired Army general who U.S. President Donald Trump ousted as his national security advisor, has amended his financial disclosure statement, revealing his ties with Russia. Flynn's new filings show the Russian state-sponsored news organization Russia Today paid him $45,000 to speak at its 10th anniversary celebration. In addition, two other Russian firms paid him several thousand dollars for speeches. As the investigation into Russia's meddling in the U.S. presidential election continues, the world is paying attention. Joining me now is Cameron Munter. He is the CEO of the East-West Institute and former ambassador to Pakistan and Serbia. Thank you for being with us. I understand you just returned from Berlin, where this was a major topic of conversation. So what exactly are our allies in Europe saying?
The European concern, especially among German diplomats, journalists and experts, is concern about the unpredictability of the American administration and the impact that the questions about Russia will have on American policy. They're very uncertain, and the whole notion of German diplomacy, the whole notion of German statecraft, is that they're most pleased when they're embedded in other institutions. They're embedded in the relationship with America, the transatlantic relationship, embedded in the EU, embedded in NATO, and they feel somewhat unmoored by that. The problem that they see here is that they see the Russians, and Americans see this as well, as trying to make sure that whatever advantage they can take from the divisions in the EU, from the divisions in NATO, that they're taking advantage of all of that. So there's a great sense of anxiety among the allies about what the Russians will be able to achieve and whether the Americans will be willing accomplices to what the Russians do.
Why are they specifically concerned? Is it because of the investigation happening, or is it because of the way this administration seems to be dealing with its allies? Or what specifically is creating or stirring up the concern?
I mean, the immediate cause is indeed the fact that the investigations seem to indicate a certain attitude towards Russia, which is not the traditional thing that you find from Americans, either Republicans or Democrats, unwillingness to talk about the what are perceived as human rights abuses or other kinds of limits on press freedom, things like that. They're unused to that. They're not used to a president who talks about moral equivalence and who is laudatory about Putin. So that's the immediate trigger. The broader thing that they're most concerned about is, does this signal a change of what has been 70 years of American policy, that the America gives guarantees to the Europeans and links them to the transatlantic community, but that now America, in using the phrase America first, is not looking towards the community of interests, but is looking towards a different approach towards politics. You know, one of the things that was always interesting to me as an American diplomat was the role that American diplomats play in representing both values and interests. You know, we're not, most diplomats don't do that kind of dance between figuring out whether values and interests can be balanced. They tend to look more towards interests. Americans have done both. That opens us up to the accusation of hypocrisy at times when we don't live up to the standards that we've talked about. But it also puts us ahead as people who stand up for the little guy, people who care about human rights. What I think a lot of people are used to is that ambiguity. And what we're seeing now is a much clearer picture, at least from the statements by President Trump, that we're going to look for America first and not be caught up in that ambiguity of values and interests.
What is your overall perspective on this situation with this and Russia investigation?
I think that it's been highly politicized, so it's very hard, given the discussion we could have about the role of media and the role of what the president calls fake news and kind of the new attitude towards information that the new administration has. I mean, there are just so many accusations and counter-accusations going back and forth that it's a very strong example of the, I guess the only word I can use is the confusion that dominates the way that the government talks about foreign policy issues and issues that in the past have been very clear. So my main concern is that what this does, this blurring of issues, all these kinds of things, and the accusations and counter-accusations that go back and forth, tend to cloud the opportunity or to make it more difficult for the traditional kind of diplomacy to deal with questions like, how does America and Russia work on non-proliferation? How do we work at the UN? How do we deal with terrorism? How do we deal with counter-narcotics? These kinds of things are basically subsumed in a domestic dialogue that has to do a lot with public diplomacy. And maybe Russia is the battlefield, but it's not really what it's about.
What is your greatest concern right now?
My greatest concern is that, at least in the American government, that we're not looking at all levels to engage with the Russians. That is, that we don't have a State Department that is fully staffed. We don't have a Defense Department that's fully staffed. We don't have people who can reach out to their counterparts, talk about, from an expert perspective, talk about the issues that we both need to be concerned about and begin to solve them as partners. As long as we don't have that, it's going to be a war of words. It's going to be just the media talking rather than professionals. And, you know, I'm biased. As a former diplomat, I think it's very important for professionals and experts to be able to get together. If you don't have a staffed State Department, if you don't have a staffed Defense Department, the people who are working at the expert level don't have the opportunity to get together and prevent conflict before it goes out of hand.
All right. Cameron Munter, CEO of the East-West Institute and former ambassador to Pakistan and Serbia. Thank you for being with us. We appreciate your perspective. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hey there, this is Shauna Renee, the lady DJ and host of Soul Lounge. Every Sunday at 1400 UTC, I choose an artist that you and I love, and we break down their entire career while listening to their biggest hits. That's what we do here on the Soul Lounge. Once again, every Sunday, 1400 UTC, right here.
I'm Victor Beatty. Since 1942, the Voice of America has been a consistently reliable and authoritative source of news. Today, VOA remains committed to providing an accurate, objective, and comprehensive news product at the top of every hour, every day. We can be heard on your local affiliate or streamed on the web at voanews.com.
VOA's International Edition continues. It's a springtime tradition in Washington, D.C. Before the leaves appear on the trees, the city's well-known cherry blossoms make their arrival. Now, unseasonably cold temperatures did freeze many of the buds that were about to bloom this year, but more than half survived. And as the delicate flowers came out this week, so did the visitors. VOA's Deborah Block went to Washington's Tidal Basin, where people are enjoying the views.
Washington's cherry blossoms are always a showstopper. Although the flowers are not as dense and vibrant as in years past, visitors from around the world still enjoyed them, including a tourist from Turkey.
I think it's pretty.
Crowds are noticeably thinner this year, likely because visitors heard that some of the buds did not bloom. But the trees are breathtaking to a woman from Chicago who is seeing the pink and white flowers for the first time.
I'm not disappointed at all. I think they're absolutely gorgeous. I'm sure there's some more pink that I've heard is out typically, but they're absolutely beautiful.
Since the cherry trees were first planted more than 100 years ago, tourists have been visiting the springtime display. Japan gave the United States 3,000 trees as a gesture of friendship. About 1,700 of them ring the Tidal Basin, the most popular spot to view the blossoms. This Chinese woman who lives in Japan says there is something magical about seeing the cherry blossoms along the reservoir by the Washington Monument and Jefferson Memorial.
I think it's a whole new different view and look. Like the monument back there is just so beautiful. You feel so welcomed by DC.
This stone lantern, carved more than 350 years ago, is also a gift from Japan. It sits among the old gnarled trees, which, despite their age, have some of the showiest flowers this year. This woman from Germany is having a good time taking photos of them.
I just can't wait to show my best friends and my family. I really think that they would love it too.
The blossoms last only a week or two. When high winds or hard rain hit the delicate flowers, they fall to the ground, ending their show until next year. Deborah Block, VOA News, Washington.
Well, turning now to what's been trending on social media, we're joined by Andrew Palchewski. Hey, Andrew, what's going on today?
So a seemingly minor change on Twitter, but it's getting a lot of reaction from Twitter fans. Now, since the beginning of Twitter, when you've registered for a Twitter account and didn't put a picture in, there would be an egg that would show up instead of your profile picture. It was this avatar, the Twitter egg, very well known among Twitter users. And Twitter went ahead and changed that egg over the weekend. Now there's a person, you see kind of a blob of a head and some shoulders, roughly a silhouette of a person. Now that seems like a minor change, didn't seem like it would upset a lot of people, but a lot of people are indeed upset about the loss of the Twitter egg. A lot of jokes about being in the Easter season, maybe them hiding the egg as in an Easter egg hunt. But there is a tinge of seriousness to this. There's a lot of talk about cyberbullying and how as people have been cyberbullied by these nameless, faceless accounts, they've been cyberbullied by people with this Twitter egg, and now they're being cyberbullied by these people with this kind of person silhouette. So it's getting a lot of talk about Twitter's action, or rather inaction, to combat cyberbullying, to combat attacks. and that kind of thing. So there is a lot of talk about that as well in the midst of this. But I'm sure Twitter didn't think it was going to be a big deal, and sure enough, it was.
It's always that
over
way.
Over an egg, of all things.
Over an egg. What else? Anything else happening?
Yeah, so over the weekend was April 1st, and of course that's April Fool's Day.
Yes.
So a number of tech companies doing some fun things. Google always every year does something fun for April Fool's Day. This year they had the capability, when you zoom in on a map, to play Mrs. Pac-Man. So you could go in a street-level view and see the grid of a street or a neighborhood, and there'd be a little button at the bottom that said insert coin, had a little Pac-Man logo. If you clicked on that, it would pop up and the streets would fill with the little dots, and you could play Miss Pac-Man running through the streets of your neighborhood. So a very cool thing that they did for April Fool's Day. A lot of people praising them for that. And something maybe a little more biting, if you will, from Snapchat. Snapchat had a filter on April 1st that looked like Instagram. So you could take a picture on Snapchat or do a video and then swipe to this filter that looked as though you were putting something up on Instagram. Now, this is a bit of a jab at Instagram and Facebook, which owns Instagram, because as we've talked about previously on the show, Facebook is trying to borrow, in some cases, some people would say steal, a lot of the ideas that Snapchat's come up with for filters, for disappearing stories, that kind of thing. Right. And they've been testing a lot of that out on Instagram, particularly the Instagram stories, which are very similar to Snapchat stories. So it was a little bit of a joke on April Fool's Day that you could put this Instagram filter up on your Snapchat. But a lot of people seeing through that joke and saying this is a little bit of a dig at Facebook and Twitter, a little bit of shots fired towards them. Perhaps Snapchat's not too happy about them stealing some of their ideas.
I bet. All right. Well, thanks so much, Andrew. You can follow him on Twitter at APAL. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA underscore IE. Well, during World War II, the Warsaw Zoo in Poland's capital became a refuge for Jews hiding from Nazi persecution. Nikki Caro's film, The Zookeeper's Wife, chronicles this true story, highlighting the courage and compassion of zookeepers Jan and Antonina Zabinski, a couple who risked their lives and the life of their son to protect those in danger. VOA's Penelope Pulu has more.
The idyllic life of Antonina and Jan Zabinski, owners of the Warsaw Zoo, ends abruptly when the Nazis invade Poland in 1939. During a Nazi air raid, most of their animals are killed, and those that survive face an uncertain future.
You need to trust me. Now, I could take your prize animals to Germany as a loan. We give them sanctuary.
Guided by greed and lust, Lutz Heck, a Nazi officer played by Daniel Brühl, offers his assistance to Antonina. Screenwriter Angela Workman says Lutz was a historic figure.
He was Hitler's chief zoologist. His family, I think, still breeds Heck cattle. And everything we say in the movie about him is true. He had feelings for Antonina. He would walk in whenever he wanted. He controlled them. He had very strong animal instincts, and I think that he was a predator in a way.
Though fearful of Heck, Antonina Zabinski manipulated his feelings to convince him to let her and her husband keep the zoo open, operating as a pig farm for the Nazi troops. Under Heck's nose, they smuggled Jews from the Warsaw Ghetto into the zoo and hid them in service tunnels and underground empty animal cages throughout the war.
You can never tell your enemies are.
Jessica Chastain depicts Antonina as nurturing with animals and humans alike.
Borrow the trust. Maybe that's why I love animals so much. You look in their eyes and you know exactly what's in their hearts.
The Zookeeper's Wife tells a Holocaust tale from a feminine perspective, says filmmaker Nikki Caro, who worked with a largely female cast and crew.
Femininity has often been equated with weakness, but a character like Antonina, or Antonina herself, shows us that you can be both very soft and very strong.
Antonina Zabinski saved about 300 Jews using the zoo as a way station. During the day, they would hide in the basement of the zoo and come out at night as soon as they heard her play the piano. That was her signal that the Nazi guards were gone for the day. At a red carpet event at the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C., screenwriter Angela Workman says, though her script was based on Diane Ackerman's novel, it was also informed by her own family history.
I'm so emotional. I'm so emotional to be in this museum because I spent an enormous amount of time here when I was writing. I feel like my family's faces are on the walls of this museum. It's such an honor to be here. I think the film is beautiful.
Jessica Chastain felt equally moved by the museum's solemn atmosphere. She said the film sends a message about today's refugee crisis.
It absolutely does. I was shocked to learn that Anne Frank's family was denied a visa to the United States twice. Antonina was a refugee. She was born and raised in Russia, and she found her safe place in Warsaw. And then from there, she created a sanctuary for others. I hope that people will see the film and be inspired by her compassion and kindness and will do what they can to help others.
What have you been up to in your little zoo?
Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Charles Hall. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
For people living in former conflict zones, war may not end for years after the last shot has been fired and the peace agreement is signed. For example, landmines and unexploded munitions, remnants of the war between the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia and the Colombian government, stand in the way of post-accord stabilization and reconstruction and inhibit long-term development. They render millions of hectares of land unusable, preventing farmers from tending their fields and herders from pasturing their cattle. In too many countries, ordinary travel is dangerous because roads are lined with minefields and a misstep could cost a passerby his or her life. Everyday activities like gathering wood or forest fruits, hauling produce to the market, or even taking a shortcut through the fields are fraught with danger. Too many children have lost their lives and limbs chasing a stray soccer ball into a minefield. That is why every April 4th we observe the United Nations International Day for Mine Awareness and Assistance in Mine Action. The observance is meant to not only remind us that dangers linger long after the conflict is done, but also to detail all the steps taken by the international community to eliminate the threat of landmines and explosive remnants of war. The United States is working closely with the international community to address this serious humanitarian challenge, which puts innocent people, including many children, at risk, said State Department Acting Spokesperson Mark Toner. Since 1993, the United States has provided over $2.8 billion in assistance for conventional weapons destruction programs in some 95 countries. These programs produce tangible, measurable, positive results by providing the expertise and equipment to safely clear landmines and other unexploded ordnance and to assist landmine accident survivors with rehabilitation and reintegration, said spokesperson Toner. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson underlined the essential role that demining plays in stabilization in Iraq and Syria as civilians seek to return home to areas liberated from ISIS, he said. On this day of mine awareness, we urge other nations to join us in a robust international partnership with the shared goal of reducing the impact of landmines around the world.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.